Köksal.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Two of a kind, the Turkish president's first visit to the White House in 6 years appeared to be full of roses and sunshine. Our guest says that's not a surprise, given the similarities between Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Donald Trump.
And nacho average win. The French may be fondue of their cheese, but this time the U.S. came out on top. The first ever American champion of the Cheesemonger World Cup tells us she cried when she heard her name called, and she hopes her victory will have an impact on the image of American cheesemongers across the board.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912, fsbbigfork.com. Member FDIC. Learn about a year in the life of North America's woodpeckers at the Sax Zim Bog near Meadowlands, Saturday, September 27th at 2 p.m. Meet at the Lois King Education Center. And we receive support from the Move-It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. Now I want to play a song for you. This is the group Bearland with In the City.
Is this what I meant to do?
I tried my best, push it away. It persevered, it's such a headache.
And that's Bearland with In the City.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
He told his father he was going to play soccer with friends, and he never came home. On Sunday, Quebec police shot and killed 15-year-old Nouran Rezaei. We reach his family's lawyer.
Contact with lenses. After several acts of vandalism, Ontario's premier says he plans to ban speed cameras. A Toronto city councillor who got a ticket in her own ward says they're crucial to keeping her citizens safe.
Oil bets are off in their first White House meeting in 6 years. Donald Trump urges the president of Turkey to stop buying Russian oil and suggests Recep Tayyip Erdogan could play a role in stopping the war in Ukraine.
Thriftus Maximus, a keen-eyed thrifter in BC, spotted what could be a cache of Roman jewelry. And now students at Simon Fraser University have been tasked with finding out if it's worth its weight in gold.
Boom and bust, an urgent update on the asteroid that might smack the moon in the face and the bold plan astronomers are considering to prevent that impact by blowing it to smithereens.
And she breezed past the competition. We'll talk to the first American to win a top French cheese competition, who, unlike a quality Stilton, has really broken the mold. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that guesses the French, have hit Rockford bottom. Nouran Rezaei should have been at school today. After school, he should have hung out with friends or with his older sister and younger brother at their home in Longueuil, Quebec. Instead, friends and family gathered at a mosque in Brossard this morning to mourn him. 15-year-old Nouran was killed on Sunday, just minutes after police received a 911 call from someone reporting a group of armed people in a public place. Eyewitnesses say a responding officer shot the teenager within seconds of arriving on the scene. And the Provincial Bureau of Independent Investigations has confirmed that the only firearm recovered was the officer's service weapon. Now the Bureau and Montreal Police are investigating Nouran's death, and his family is struggling to make sense of their loss by remembering him as the fun-loving kid he was.
Just like any 15-year-old teenager, you know, wanting to live his life, see his friends, you know, after school, play sports, go outside, crack jokes. So a normal teenager, full of life, full of ambitions and possibilities. So a great kid. He was always smiling, was always kind, loving to his cousins, to his siblings.
Nouran Rezaei's second cousin, Zara Kademi, describing him to the CBC's Gloria Enriquez. Fernando Belton is a lawyer representing the Rezaei family. We reached him in Montreal.
Fernando, how is Nouran's family holding up right now?
Well, today was the funeral of Nouran, so it's really a difficult day. Everyone I met talked about Nouran as being a sweet kid, someone who likes his friend, likes to hang out. He was really a regular kid, yeah. And it's really, really a difficult loss for them today.
What have they and his family told you about what they know about what happened on Sunday afternoon?
The information that the family knows so far comes from people who were present and doesn't come from the police. So far, we have an independent investigation that's going on. We haven't received much information from that bureau, but from what we know that Nouran was hanging out with his friend. There was a call that was made by a neighbor saying that there were armed people that was hanging out around the neighborhood. The police came and somehow they shot Nuran. We know that no weapon was retrieved from the crime scene. So it raises a lot of questions about the use of force and the reason why little force was used in that interception.
No one was armed, as you said. I believe only the police officer's weapon was retrieved from the scene. There are also questions about how long it took police to inform the family that their son had been killed. What do you know about that and why that was?
The why, we don't know. But what I can tell you is that Nuran was shot at 14:58, so 2:58 p.m. And it took about 5 hours that police called Nuran's family to tell them what happened. He was already dead at that moment. And we have no explanation whatsoever why it took so much time, because the incident happened with his best friends, so they were present. They could have given any information regarding the death that just happened, and they were 10 minutes from Nuran's house. But we don't know why. We haven't gotten any information.
Quebec's Bureau des Enquêtes Indépendantes held a press conference about Nuran's death after it happened. That in and of itself, I understand, is a bit unusual. We'll play for you and our listeners a short clip of what BEI Director Brigitte Bishop said on Tuesday.
If somebody saw something, has something, has detained evidence, to please call our office and we're going to gather the evidence. We're the you have to trust us. We're the one who are doing the investigation. We're an independent office. Our mission is to shed the light on what happened, and that's what we're going to do.
She's asking for the public to speak up if they know something. She's also asking people to trust the BEI and how it's going to investigate this. As you likely know, Quebec's League of Rights is questioning that the BEI is acting with, quote, complete impartiality, unquote. Where do you and the family sit on that front?
Well, first and foremost, the family is going to give all their cooperation and help to the BEI investigators. That being said, we have to see, when we look at the number of investigation that was made since 2016, we're talking about 466. There was only two investigations that led to criminal accusation and no conviction. That's their number. When we look at those numbers, we can understand why people who are looking at police brutality cases don't trust the BEI. And it's important in this case that information is given in a timely manner to make sure that the family knows, is aware of how the investigation is going, and that the population also is aware of any step further that's going to be taken into that investigation.
The BEI has said it has 15 investigators on this case. Does that number reassure you at all?
I think the most important thing for us is to be assured that when a police officer take the life of someone, that if criminal accusation is in order, that that's the step that's been taken. That's the only number that we're looking at. For now, the number is zero. And a lot of people are angry. A lot of people are asking questions, do not understand why this intervention led to the death of Nuran. So it's important to keep that in mind.
The officer involved in this has been placed on a, quote, work stoppage for an undetermined period, unquote. Their status is said to be reviewed, their employment status, based on the findings eventually from the BEI. How is the family feeling about that reality?
Well, we're surely hoping that that police officer is not placed back into his duties on the road. A life was taken. I think until the investigation is completed, that police officer shouldn't be on the road.
There's a vigil planned for this weekend, we know. You mentioned the anger that people are feeling. What do you feel, Fernando, would help alleviate that anger and those questions in this moment?
Well, the family has been really clear about the fact that we want everyone to be peaceful. We want everyone to keep in mind that we want to pay respect to Nuran, pay respect to his memory. He was a peaceful kid. So we want that march to be peaceful as well. The family has their own anger and their own sadness regarding what happened, but it's really important that that's the spirit of the march, that everyone stays peaceful and that we pay respect to Nohan.
Fernando, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Fernando Belton is a lawyer for Nohan Rezaei's family. We reached him in Montreal. In a statement on social media, Longueuil Police Chief Patrick Bélanger said the force will cooperate fully with all investigations and that, quote, we understand the deep sadness felt by this young man's family, friends, and all those who supported him, unquote. When it comes to international visitors, U.S. President Donald Trump isn't always the most welcoming guy. But today he greeted Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan with a smile. It was the first time the two leaders have met in Washington since President Trump's first term, which ultimately culminated in Mr. Trump removing Turkey from the United States' F-35 fighter jet program. He kicked his country's longtime ally out because Turkey had bought a Russian air defense system. We don't know whether that ban will be lifted, but today's sit-down did open the door to stronger relations. Here's President Trump in the Oval Office today when asked what role Turkey could play in getting Russian and Ukrainian leaders to the negotiating table.
Well, I can tell you that President Erdogan is very respected by both of them. Everybody respects Erdogan. They really respect Erdogan. I do. And I think he could have a big influence if he wants to. Right now, he's very neutral. He likes being neutral. So do I like being neutral. But he's somebody that, if he got involved, the best thing he could do is not buy oil and gas from Russia. If he did that, that would be probably the best thing.
Aslı Aydıntaşbaş studies Turkish politics and is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. We reached her in Washington, D.C.
Aslı, what did you make of what the U.S. president was saying there? Could Turkey's president, President Erdogan, have an influence on where things go between Russia and Ukraine?
Well, President Trump really showered Erdogan with praise in today's meeting, which is actually Erdogan is a controversial figure certainly in Europe and has also been criticized for his human rights record. But yes, it is. He's also a very skillful geopolitical actor. So, and as such, I do think that Trump is right in pointing out that he does get a lot of countries' attention and has been able to sort of see a rising influence for Turkey across the region. But whether he can determine the outcome of the Ukraine-Russia war, that is not clear to me. And I think that it's also not clear whether or not Trump does want to go ahead and sanction countries that buy Russian oil and gas. He did bring it up. This was not apparently expected by the Turkish side. Mm-hmm. This is a new talking point for President Trump.
In terms of the political theater of it all, you wrote in your piece for Brookings that this is a bromance revived, but also that personal chemistry alone cannot solve all of the sticking points, the issues between these two leaders and these two countries. So as you watch that bit of political theater unfold, and I think people who followed President Erdogan know he's not known to stay silent for that long, you know, what is the end game here of the video and audio we get from this sit down?
It's hard to tell sometimes with President Trump how his negotiating strategy always starts off with praise and then ask comes later.
Right.
And I think that while it sounds like it was all roses and romance and bromance today, it is very much an opportunity for a reset in the relationship, mm-hmm. that will come at a cost for Turkey.
Gaza was certainly an important topic between these two leaders. President Erdogan addressed the UN General Assembly earlier this week, calling on world leaders to stand up for Palestinians. Today, though, Donald Trump said he doesn't know what Erdogan's stance on Gaza is. What did you take away from what was said about Gaza and Palestinians in this sit-down?
So Trump clearly knows what Erdogan thinks about it. Erdogan has said from the beginning that this was a genocide, and he's even called Benjamin Netanyahu Hitler, a modern-day Hitler, and so on. And there's an ongoing spat between the two countries. So the divide, the divergence between the two countries on this issue is very clear. But so was the determination not to have a public spat on this issue in front of cameras. It was conspicuous that Erdogan has not opened his mouth about Gaza, that he let this sort of comments pass by. And so that, to me, signals that there is a desire not to have this issue come in between. But they were cautious not to have a public split over the issue today.
People in both of these countries that these men represent are asking questions about human rights and democracy. In Turkey, we know Erdogan's biggest opposition rival, Istanbul's mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, remains in jail. He wrote today in The Guardian that he believes Turkish democracy is, quote, under grave threat. You wrote in your own piece about the similarities between these two presidents. What should American voters take away from those similarities?
I don't think the Trump administration cares about the domestic issues. In fact, they have made it very explicit, very clear that they do not want democracy and human rights as an item in the bilateral agenda. They don't want it to be a hurdle in bilateral relations, and they are willing to ignore it. Trump clearly respects Erdogan as a strongman. There's no doubt about it. That includes democratic backsliding or his authoritarian instincts at home. And it includes his openness to using power, projecting power, even hard power in his own neighborhood. I think that to him is what leadership looks like, what a strong leader looks like. Some of the qualities that have led the Biden administration to keep Erdogan at arm's length, or Europeans to keep him at arm's length, are very much the things he likes and respects. And I think there is a tale of caution for the U.S. here as they, as Americans, think of, worry about democratic backsliding at home. They should pay particular attention to issues like the independent organization, the sort of things like FCC, you know, the independent or the central bank, the Fed, taking away their independence, or pressures on media, pressures on free speech, getting people fired for stuff they say on the air, which are steps that led to Erdogan's consolidation of power and stuff Turks have witnessed 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and eerily similar in that sense.
Aslı, I appreciate this always. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
Aslı Aydıntaşbaş is an expert in Turkish politics and a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. We reached her in Washington, D.C. Today at the UN General Assembly in New York, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had everyone's full attention. He thanked all countries that have recognized the state of Palestine, including Canada, and called on the remaining countries to do the same. He described what government might look like in the territories once the war is over, and reiterated his call for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Mr. Abbas delivered his speech over video after the Trump administration denied him and about 80 other Palestinians a visa to attend the summit. Here's some of what he said in translation.
What Israel is carrying out is not merely an aggression. It is a war crime and a crime against humanity that is both documented and monitored. And it will be recorded in history books and the pages of International Conscience as one of the most horrific chapters of humanitarian tragedy in the 20th and 21st centuries. Despite all what our people have suffered, we reject what Hamas carried out on the 7th of October. These actions that targeted Israeli civilians and took them hostages, because these actions do not represent the Palestinian people, nor do they represent their just struggle for freedom and independence. We say to our sons and daughters in the homeland, in the exile, and in the diaspora, no matter how much our wounds bleed, and no matter how long this suffering lasts, it will not break our will to live and survive. The dawn of freedom will emerge, and the flag of Palestine will fly high in our skies.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas speaking through an interpreter by video today at the UN General Assembly. Sandy Parker manages a thrift store in Chilliwack, BC, so she comes across a lot of interesting finds. But she says some things that turned up last year were on a whole other level. Here's what she told CBC Vancouver this morning about the items.
We had 11 rings and 2 medallions. Our assistant manager, Stephanie, was tasked with figuring out where what they were and maybe what they were worth, but there was little to no information online that she could find. And after, you know, quite some time, she finally gave up and we just thought we'll sell them as is.
And so you put a $30 price tag on each one.
Yeah, we got very fortunate when a person walked into the store and thought they might be something special and urged us to contact SFU.
And what did he have to say? He was an archaeologist, I understand.
Yes, he had a background in archaeology, and he figured they were just something special and needed further looking into.
That is Sandy Parker from Thrifty Boutique in Chilliwack talking to CBC host Stephen Quinn. As she mentioned SFU there, that's Simon Fraser University, and that is where Sabrina Higgins comes in. She's an associate professor in the Department of Global Humanities and Archaeology. And next fall, she'll be teaching a special new course along with her colleague in the Department of Archaeology, Assistant Professor Cara Tremaine, and it will be exclusively based on these items found at Thrifty Boutique. We reached Sabrina Higgins in New Westminster, British Columbia.
Sabrina, all of the things that had to fall into place, the people, the thrift store employees, this person with the archaeology background who's remaining anonymous, the timing. I mean, first of all, do you love all of these people?
Of course. I mean, this is amazing. I've never experienced anything like this in my career.
And also the what could have been. It could have been someone else who thought, hey, $30, these look nice.
Right? Not a bad price for something that could be ancient.
Yeah. So it all fell into place, but for you, this started about a year ago. You get an email.
Yes.
When you look at an email like that, that's hinting at something like this, I mean, do you think it's spam? Do you think it's junk mail or a scam?
It's not infrequent for me to get emails from people who have collections that are looking for valuations. And that's something that I don't do from an ethical perspective. So I always approach these emails with caution, but I was intrigued by the fact that it was coming from a thrift store, that they wanted to get more information about these objects, and it was someone who was local. So I consulted with my colleagues at the Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology, and we decided that we would reply and see what they were looking for, if it was more of a donation or evaluation. And once we met with them, it was very clear from the outset of the meeting that they were looking to donate the objects to us and had no interest in getting evaluation. And then we were really happy to move forward.
You've done preliminary analysis on some of these items. What time period do you think they're from?
So we've done basic visual analysis and some analysis under a microscope. From what I'm seeing thus far, the wear on the objects, the design on the objects, they look ancient to me. Now, at what time period, that's going to be a question for our students to come up with. But one of the objects in particular to me, which leads me to think of a date that's in sort of the late antique period, so 4th, 5th, 6th century, is the smaller of the two medallions, which if you look at the medallion, you can see there's a cross that goes across it, but there's also a vertical line. And under a microscope, you can see a semicircle that's attached to the top of that vertical line, which as an early Christian archaeologist immediately screams out to me that that's what we would call a Cairo, the symbol for Christ. So that's what led me to think that these are ancient, they're probably late antique, and then maybe into the medieval period with some of the other ones. But they don't look like they came from the same hoard. Some of them look a little bit earlier, some of them look a little bit later. So it seems to me that this is someone's personal collection that was donated to this boutique, and we have a range of dates in there.
And since the story has, you know, made headlines, has anyone come forward? Do you know anything more about who dropped them off at the store?
No, and I think that would be incredible for the class that we're about to teach if that person did come forward, largely because that's another piece of the story that we're missing. You know, did this person work potentially as an archaeologist overseas? Did they get them through a collection house or an auction house, rather? Is there any documentation that was potentially attached to these objects? So if that person were to come forward, that would be absolutely incredible. And we could interview them with our students to get more information.
And that's another key part of this as well, because Simon Fraser University, its press release says the museum doesn't usually collect items without proper documentation because they might have been looted illegally.
Exactly.
So
yes,
that's part of your what your teaching materials and your class discussions will be about?
Absolutely. So we faced a really important ethical dilemma when we decided to accept these objects, because we don't know the context from which they came. Were they bought through an auction house? Were they looted? Were they bought through the black market? And, you know, we don't want to contribute to those markets. So we thought, is it better for them to stay at the thrift store and not accept them, and then they continue to circulate in the market? Or do we, as an institution that has public trust, take care of these belongings and use them as educational material? And ultimately, that was the decision, the route that we went with. And that's going to be central to the course. You know, what were the ethical implications behind these? What does looting and the black market, illegal excavations, how does that contribute to, you know, the issues that archaeologists are constantly facing with these objects that don't have any provenance?
You sound like a very enthusiastic lecturer, someone who loves what you do. But have you ever been this excited to put together a class?
No, I am beyond thrilled that I get to do this class, and I get to teach it with a colleague of mine, Cara Tremaine.
Yeah.
This will probably be the most exciting class that I teach in my career. It's not often that you get to take students through a research project at a museum from start to finish, you know, from the accession to the research to the scientific analysis to the publication of these and then the creation of an exhibition. And we're learning alongside them as we go. Yeah. We'll be doing that research with them. So this is going to be a really collaborative class that we're so excited to teach.
And you'll share the surprises, the excitement, but potential disappointment as well that you're preparing yourself and the students for, I'm sure, because you could find out that they're not authentic, that they're not
Absolutely.
What you think they are, right?
Yeah, they could be modern forgeries. And, you know, with a collection this large, it wouldn't be unheard of that one or more of the objects in here could be a forgery. And that's going to be part of the discovery process. And then interesting conversations can, of course, revolve around those findings. So we're really going to be treating this as a on-the-go, continuously developing class that has, you know, a set curriculum, but also meets the sort of challenges that our students are facing as we go through the analysis.
Sabrina, thank you for this.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
Simon Fraser University Associate Professor Sabrina Higgins in New Westminster, BC.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, a Toronto city councillor says she knows it's annoying when you get a ticket because you're caught by a speed camera, but she got one in her own ward. She warns that if he bans those cameras, Ontario's Premier Doug Ford will be putting people's lives at risk.
And we'll remember an Edmonton ICU doctor, an avid mountain biker, who carried naloxone on his bike ride to and from the office so he could save as many lives as possible during the city's overdose crisis. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
It is 6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program, here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Ben Frankenstein. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Carefully and lovingly, that's how to install your child's car seat correctly. Remember, you're driving this decision. Drive smart and get your precious cargo home safely. A message from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids hosts an opening reception for their new exhibit, Unearthed, Friday, October 3rd from 4 to 7. It's a two-person mixed media show developed from foraged objects. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens.
Looks like a certain mysterious Toronto vandal or vandals may have finally won their vigilante battle against speed cameras. As we told you recently, a camera to catch speeders on a busy stretch of road in the city has been cut down and replaced 7 times. Earlier this month, 16 other speed cameras around the city were chopped down as well. And throughout the city's ordeal, Ontario Premier Doug Ford has made it clear that he is not on the side of the cameras. Today, he put his foot down.
Over the last few years, we've seen municipalities across the province use municipal speed cameras as nothing more than a cash grab. In Toronto, a single speed camera produced, now hear this again, a single speed camera produced more than 65,000 tickets and charged drivers nearly $7 million. In a few weeks, our government will introduce legislation to ban speed cameras in Ontario to protect taxpayers and drivers and stop them from being gouged. Instead of punishing people retroactively with speeding tickets days or weeks after the fact, we're supporting practical, proactive traffic calming measures that stop people from speeding in the first place.
Shelley Carroll is a city councillor and the chair of the Toronto Police Services Board. We reached her in Toronto.
Councillor Carroll, in your ward, are speed cameras, as Premier Ford was saying, they're just a cash grab for the city of Toronto?
Well, no, they're an important tool that we use to affect driver behavior. And the ward that I represent is a suburban ward just north of the 401. And having been, you know, really kind of over-designed in some of its roadways, really needs the help of technology to help police be able to affect behavior in our neighborhood.
Have those cameras actually changed driver behavior? What kind of change have you seen in your ward since the installation of the cameras there?
Well, they have. I have a camera in my ward that is one of the busiest. It broke the record when we first started our program, but the number of tickets issued there when the camera first went in, 9,000 tickets were issued in 1 month. And that indicates not a cash grab. It indicates a problem, in my view. We had a problem with people in a straightaway stretch very near a school, but also near Don Mills and Shepherd, an intersection with lots of traffic. When you get to the straightaway, we had people driving recklessly. And so the camera has actually brought that down. I'm one of the people who got a ticket there.
Yeah. And how did you feel after getting that ticket?
Well, it was pretty easy for me to sort of come to grips with it. You received this thing in the mail a week later, and I thought, darn it, why there? You know, it's the first place after you've been stuck in traffic. Mm-hmm. But then I realized, yeah, we do fly down the hill in that straightaway stretch, and we do have to change.
What have you heard from constituents?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because when the premier started indicating that he might have legislation, I reached out to my residents. And I disclosed, you know, I too have been caught by that camera, but I stand by this program. It has made changes, 45% change in driver behavior as studied by Sick Kids Hospital and the Toronto Metropolitan University, and told them about some of our accident and fatality stats going down at the Police Service Board reporting. And what I got back was, it was sort of disclosure time in Don Valley North. A lot of people wrote back saying, yes, I've received a ticket, or I received two or three when it first came in, but it has changed me. Don't get rid of the program.
We've talked about on this show, the premier was alluding to it in that clip we heard there, a camera that keeps getting ripped down around Toronto's Parkside Drive area. It had brought in a lot of money, but the advocate we spoke to, you know, was concerned concerned about the measures there and the fact that it was torn down over and over again. And Premier Ford, as you know, is saying that they can put in place measures that will stop people from speeding rather than punishing them after the fact, weeks after the fact. Could, you know, speed bumps and other road measures not be potentially a better solution than these cameras?
Well, I'll tell you, Parkside Drive is a perfect example of road design measures can't do the whole job, because that's an area where we have a highly residential, school populated, and one of the biggest parks in the country, High Park here in Toronto, on one side of it, and everyone wanting to get there on foot. And so lots of the road measures that the premier described this morning have been used there, up to and including a signalized intersection to make it a less attractive place. But people continue to treat that road as their own personal high-speed ramp that gets me down to the bottom of the hill and onto the Gardiner.
You're part of the Police Services Board. Are you hearing anything from Toronto Police?
Well, yes, we've had a number of conversations about how we would cope with this. And you know, the bottom line is we have a number of serious crimes to deal with in the city of Toronto. And so our service will do their level best in order to try and enforce the speed manually, but they can't do it all. And we're at a point where people want no congestion. They want nothing to take away from road width where we have it. And so manual speed enforcement means taking a lane out every time you pull a car over. And so, you know, there will be times when we should be enforcing and we'll be pressured not to because it affects traffic and rush hour. There will be things like that going on all across the city.
Why do you think Premier Ford is focusing on this and is so adamant about this issue right now?
Honestly, you know, when I look at some of the mayors who they recount tales of, I got a phone call from this person who was mad to receive a ticket or that person. It's bowing to the pressures from the few and risking the safety of the masses. A few people have phoned irate that they got a ticket. That's not my first instinct to phone the premier because I got a ticket. For some, I guess it was. But, you know, many, many lives are saved by using this tool along with police service enforcement. And those lives are going to be lost because a few people phoned mad that they got this new magic word, dinged. Getting dinged with a ticket is now a terrible thing. It's not you got dinged because you broke the law. That's really troubling.
Have you spoken to Premier Ford about this directly, or do you plan to?
I have not spoken to him directly yet. We're going to move some motions as a group, as council. Other municipalities in Ontario are doing the same. Our mayor has written a collaborative motion saying there are things we can do to improve the program. And we would prefer to take that approach. And so I will, as chair of the police board, I'll be part of that conversation and will, of course, be speaking to Doug directly. And what I'll say is, you know, if the car has a problem, let's not trash it. Let's take it into the shop and fix it.
Councillor Carroll, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
You bet. Thanks.
Shelley Carroll is a Toronto City Councillor and the chair of the Toronto Police Services Board. Today, two separate Edmonton communities are mourning cyclist and physician Darren Markland. As a mountain biker and advocate for active transportation, he loved the outdoors with an enthusiasm that was infectious. And as an ICU physician, he was similarly passionate about his work and made headlines for speaking out about the opioid crisis, the pressures facing Alberta hospitals, and more. Dr. Markland died in a mountain bike crash on Sunday in Nordegg, Alberta, and our CMP investigation is underway. 2 years ago, Darren Markland was a guest on this program where he talked about carrying a naloxone kit on his regular mountain bike rides around Edmonton and about an overdose epidemic that he compared to COVID-19.
This is a health crisis of incredible proportions. But the problem is we're being willfully ignorant about it, using ideology to marginalize these people so that we don't feel bad when they die.
What do you mean by that, using ideology?
We've had these problems for years, but our direction in the last 4 years has been completely wrong and non-scientific. We're now looking at enforcing therapy, which we know doesn't work. What I'd like to do is just open up the dialogue, open up, you know, the situation that we're in. Instead of demonizing people with mental health problems, look at it as the issue it is. It is. If you want a bullet list of things, one, I would like to see safe injection sites back and safe consumption sites back. I would like to open up inner city mental health services. We need guaranteed income. We need services and housing for these people, regardless of how morally people feel about this. From a strict economic sense, this makes incredible budgetary and fiscal sense. Just keeping people in hospital and treating them when we go through all these therapies is incredibly expensive. And if you look at the research, to do all these things without treating the underlying determinants of health doesn't bring us any closer to a solution.
There are some people I understand you have found when you're on your way home, when you're cycling on those bike paths, that you're too late to help. I mean, you're an ICU doctor, you see a lot, but how is this impacting you when you go home at the end of a day?
Actually, it's part of what motivates me. I remember very clearly riding a trail it's near the university. It's literally hundreds of meters from a street. And smelling that smell of human decomposition and the fear and dread that hit me because I knew it was coming around the corner. And it was incredibly traumatic. I mean, I do this. I often ride these trails because I ride with naloxone and I use a lot of it in a week. But to see someone who could have been my daughter in that position, in that state, literally hundreds of meters from one of our best universities, that affected me in ways that I can't even describe.
ICU Dr. Darren Markland talking to As It Happens guest host Robin Bresnahan in July 2023. Dr. Markland died this week in a cycling accident in Alberta. The French may feel they've mastered all the cheeses, but last week at the Cheesemonger World Cup in Tours, France, an American walked away with all the marbles, all the cheese-related marbles. Amelia Dalbero is the first American to win that competition, where she sliced, tasted, and even sculpted her way past Europe's best. We reached Ms. Dalbero at her home in Philadelphia.
Amelia, this is, I hear, a huge, huge honor. Is it something you've always dreamed of, to become the winner of the Cheesemonger World Cup?
Honestly, I have to say that it is. Very early on in my career, I heard about the Cheesemonger Invitational and how I was working at the same counter as the first female winner of that challenge. And I said, I really want to do that. I want to be just like her. and then as I went through the different iterations of the Cheesemonger Invitational, it became clear that this was the goal. And it is a huge honor to be the first American to win the competition.
9 challenges, 8 hours. Mm-hmm. Which ones were the toughest for you?
Oh, for me, the written test was definitely one of the harder challenges. Definitely took some educated guessing and then some where I didn't even know where to start, but we made it through.
What kinds of questions?
Oh, things like, can you identify this breed of sheep that is commonly used for the production of this PDO cheese? This is a picture of a mold. Can you identify it and the defect that is associated with it? Something like, what temperature should the milk be heated to for coagulation for this style of cheese? Just a lot of very specific, in-depth questions.
Then there's tasting, of course, blind tasting. How did you do there?
I did pretty well. I got two of them. As far as I know, I got two of them completely correct. And then the other two cheeses, I got some of the attributes correct, but not all of them.
Part of the skill set that was tested is your ability to measure out, without any measuring tools, a specific amount of cheese. How did that go?
They gave us a half wheel of Roquefort and then a smaller kind of tome style cheese. Mm-hmm. And you can use whatever tools to cut it that you wanted, but you had to get perfect half pounds. That one was tougher for me because I haven't worked behind a cheese counter full time for a few years, but I did as much practice as I could. And a lot of it is really just muscle memory. So I tried to kind of relax and let that take over for that challenge.
What do you think put you over the edge ultimately? Because it sounds like, you know, you were really challenged at each of these,
definitely,
you know, stages. So what set you apart and got you this win?
I was very, very organized. I had practiced all of the challenges as much as I could, as often as I could. I had a binder full of photos as kind of a guide for what I needed to put in which place. The only really mystery part of it was which cheeses we were going to get. So I tried to practice with as many different types of cheese as I could.
You didn't go to culinary school. How did you get into cheesemongering even before, you know, deciding to compete?
I didn't. I don't actually have a food background at all in terms of like culinary school or, you know, working in restaurants or anything like that. I was working for Eataly in New York City, and I settled on cheese. I was always the most interested in the cheese pairing classes, and I decided to get a job behind the Eataly cheese counter, which was an amazing place to work. I learned so much. It's the second largest counter in New York City at the time. So it was definitely a baptism by fire. But
New Yorkers are known to be very patient, especially when they're waiting for an order for something,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, very patient.
That's what I thought. Good. Thank you for confirming that. I think the best, I don't think they're award-winning, but the best cheesemongers I've come across, they really know the history and the story of the cheese that they're telling you about or that you're asking about. Where does story fit into a particular cheese for you?
My partner and I are both cheesemongers, and we talk about the aspects of storytelling and stewardship. It's important to think about how much work goes into making these cheeses. It's backbreaking manual labor and thinking about getting it from point A to point B, whether that's somewhere in Europe or somewhere in the United States. And so telling the story of the cheese not only keeps the history alive, but it also helps to create new appreciation for that cheese.
Tell me the cheese that is never missing from your refrigerator.
Oh, Parmigiano Reggiano for sure.
Why?
Because it was the first cheese that showed me that cheese could be an experience rather than just an ingredient. So it's a very versatile cheese. You can cook with it. You can use it as a garnish. You can really do anything with it. But different parms are also different, and they taste very different based on age or where the milk comes from. When you buy Parm from different producers, you get something new every time. So it's always an adventure.
Many of our listeners listen to our show live, and it's usually around dinner time or maybe when they're getting dinner ready. What are a couple of pairings, maybe unexpected, that you want them to know about as they set their tables?
Well, a classic pairing that I always like to tell people, especially as a starter or an appetizer, is anything bubbly, like champagne or Prosecco, things like that.
Those go
really well with higher fat cheeses, like a triple cream or like a double triple cream brie or a Briat Savarin, things like that. Mm-hmm. One of my other favorite pairings is chocolate with either blue cheese or like a mountain cheese. For some reason, chocolate is just, it just goes really well with those Alpine style cheeses.
Yeah. But a blue cheese, for me, that's controversial. Chocolate, yes. Not sure about the blue cheese.
With the blue cheese, it's interesting because some of them can be very spicy. Mm. So you want something sweet to kind of neutralize that and bring it down to a more manageable level, especially if you're not a blue cheese lover.
There will be a lot of discussions about this, Amelia. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much.
Amelia Dalbero is a gold medalist at this year's Cheesemonger World Cup. She's the first ever American champion. She's in Philadelphia. Time now for another ominous edition of our ongoing series, Asteroid Watch. At my high school, there was this one bully. Whenever he'd walk by another kid, he'd suddenly raise his fist and then he'd say, "Hi, you flinched." But how could they not flinch? He was a powerful, intimidating guy with a certain je ne sais quoi. Anyway, I just want to apologize to my classmates for doing that. You know who's not apologizing, though? Asteroid 2024 YR4. It's what's known as a near-Earth object, in the same way that my youthful fist was a near-face object. The 65-meter-long space rock made us flinch in June when we learned it might punch our planet in the face. Then we learned it wouldn't hit us, but it might hit our best friend, the moon. And if it does, it will cause the lunar equivalent of a nosebleed, sending up 100 million kilograms of moon chunks, some of which might bash into our satellites. Well, astronomers have taken enough of 2024 YR4's guff. And in a new study, not yet peer-reviewed, they've laid out a battle plan that might include a kinetic disruption mission. No, I didn't know either, but it turns out that that means a mission in which they plant explosive devices on that asteroid bully, two 100-kiloton nuclear devices to be exact, and blow it up into smaller, harmless pieces. Now, 2024 YR4 is still about 610 million kilometers away, but if they want to put these bombs on it, they'll have to decide soon. We will keep you posted because, frankly, we are sick of this bullying asteroid trying to scare us. And if these astronomers manage to blow it up, well, bully for them. Here are the Beaches with Blow Up.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.